So welcome to another podcast of a series that I've called Tales from the Battlefields by me, Terry Wenham. And this week I wanted to do something different. Last weekend, a group of friends, some of which are battlefield guides and some are just people with an interest in the battlefields, made our way over to the Somme for a few days walking the battlefields. And there's something special about doing that at this time of the year. Of course, in late February, the weather in Northern Europe and on the Somme in particular can be very changeable, very cold and not very welcoming. But we can't resist it. Many of us guides tend to go over to the battlefields and walk them at this time of year because it's before the crowds have arrived and before we're needed to do battlefield tours, either for our own small businesses or for companies like Ledger that we work for. It seems to me at this time of year, the skies are bright. They're often bright anyway, with that winter sunshine. The skies are large. They seem very large, and the fields appear to want to give up their stories from that hot summer 107 years ago and the damp autumn that followed. So this podcast is all about what we saw and what we experienced during a cold weekend on the Somme. Before, as I said, before the coach parties appear and the crops grow and the leaves in the tree, which, of course, are so important to the economy on the Somme. But during those summer months, when the crops are at their highest, it's sometimes difficult to get an understanding of the detail of those battlefields themselves. So it's the right time to do this if you can put up with the cold as we did last weekend. But before we go into that, before I start talking about some of the things that we found on the Somme last weekend, I wanted to update you with a couple of bits of information from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which I'm a volunteer for. And the first thing is to give a good plug to what the Commission calls War Graves Week, which will take place in the UK and other countries between the 20th and the 28th of May this year. And it will be the third year that this event has been run. And it's planned for this weekend because it's the anniversary of the organisation, the Commission's foundation. It initially started in the UK in 2021, but in 2022 it went into Europe, and the plan is that this year it's actually going to go global. And there's going to be a theme. There's going to be a theme to the week. Three words: discover, learn, remember. And the aim is to increase the public recognition and awareness of the work of not just the Commission, but their charitable arm, which is the Commonwealth War Graves Foundation. So the idea is that we'll be encouraging people to discover the amazing sites through tours, open day events and educational visits. People will learn about the incredible work which the Commission does and be encouraged to visit the website and learn about the records and the archives. And through these activities, the Commission will be encouraging people to remember those that the Commission commemorates, who we commemorate, and to get more involved, maybe through future events or volunteering or even becoming a member of the foundation itself. And as volunteers, we're going to be heavily involved in this. One of the weekends of War Graves Week, I'll be conducting tours around a couple of Commonwealth War Graves Commission plots in civil cemeteries here in Northampton. And I know that these events will be taking place all over the country, so stay tuned in for more information about that. And the other news that I wanted to bring you was about the Menin Gate, the famous Menin Gate in Ypres. And as many people will know, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission have decided that there will be a major restoration project that will take place from about now, really. And they don't know how long it's going to last because of the amount of work that's required. But they decided it was important that this happens now, because in July 2027, which is, well, less than 4 years away, it will be the centenary of the opening of that wonderful memorial when Lord Plumer stood underneath the gate and said those immortal words, "He is not missing, he is here." So when it comes to actually restoring the Menin Gate, of course, it's going to be a very complex and challenging project. And the Commission want to do it in several stages, really, and to achieve several different objectives. The first thing is to clean the brickwork and replace some of the missing, or all of the missing and damaged bricks. If you look closely, you can see that many of them have been damaged over the years. The stonework is going to be cleaned and restored, including the lion that's on top of the memorial. The roof will be repaired, and the waterproofing that protects the interior of the memorial from water damage also needs to be repaired. There'll be a new eco roof installed, and that will extend the lifespan of the waterproofing. And it will also encourage biodiversity and ecology to flourish. The ceilings, they need to be repainted. They're very intricate ceilings on the memorial, if you look up at them. And they require extensive preparation because there's actually asbestos is present in the current paint layers. And of course, that's not good news. So that'll have to be taken out. And what we always look at when we go to the main gate, are the names on the panels, and they all need to be assessed. And some of them will need to be restored by stonemasons. And of course, they'll have to do that in situ. New lighting will be installed, and that will reduce energy consumption and reduce maintenance costs as well. So important in this day and age. And there's other details, other features across the memorial that will need to be cleaned and restored. And if you go on to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website and type in the Minning Gate, you'll see some photos that demonstrate the work that needs to be required. And there are some areas that you don't see when you go to the gate within the memorial itself. And there are concrete foundations that will need to be looked at. And also there's internal stairs that lead to the roof. And there's one particular photograph on the Commission's website that shows what a dreadful condition, which is what you'd expect from a building that's, what, now 96 years old. It's going to need to be repaired. So it's going to cause some inconvenience and some frustration. The Last Post Association, they're talking about, of course, there's no way the Last Post ceremony would be cancelled for this period. That will continue. It will continue outside of the gate. We haven't actually had details of how that's going to work yet. But of course, I'll bring you news of that as and when we know it. So a lot of work to be done at the Menin Gate, just like there was at Teat Vale. And it's something that we're going to have to manage when we visit that beautiful memorial in that wonderful city of Ypres. And what gets me always when we enter the Somme battlefields, whether I'm driving myself or with a party of people, is that usually you come in off of the motorway near Bapaume, and within a few minutes you cross a sign that tells you we're at the position where the battle ended in November of 1916. And within about 10 minutes, you've done the 7 mile journey down to La Boisselle. And there's another sign telling you that that's the position where the battle started on the 1st of July. And it's, as I said, it's taken about 10 minutes. Of course, it always amazes me as I explain to the people I'm with that whilst it's taken us just a few minutes to cover that journey in reverse, 100 years ago plus, it took the Commonwealth troops over 4 months to slog their way either side of that main road in terrible conditions in the end, in the autumn of 1916, and at the cost, of course, of hundreds of thousands of casualties. And one of those casualties was my great uncle Henry, who I talked about in the first podcast, if you go back and listen to that, Tale of Two Brothers. And whenever we get close to Auvillé, I'll look across to the right, there's a blue and white farm building as the road drops away down to a lane, and then the ground goes up again. And on that hill, as it heads up towards Moquet Farm, there was a major German trench called Ration Trench. And that's where my great uncle Henry's story ended. And I always look across there and I always look at him and wonder what he went through on that night in August 1916, all those years ago. To me, that part of the Somme battlefield will always be part of me, part of my family history, and the reason why I keep returning to the Somme week after week, month after month, year after year. So what tales did we find when we walked those battlefields last week? What did those brave men leave behind? Well, let's find out in this podcast. These are a completely random collection of stories, really, that we picked up over the weekend. Just a few of the hundreds of thousands of stories that you will find when hopefully you explore these wide open spaces, cemeteries and farm tracks on the Somme. They're there for us all to explore. Most of these stories, if not all of them, are not famous men or well-known men. They're just ordinary men who created their own little bit of history in these fields. So let's go exploring. Let's do this together. These men left an imprint on time for us to follow, learn, teach, explore, discuss and remember. And that's what I want to do in this podcast today. So let's get going then. Let's look at the first set of stories, which is a cemetery that we visited on our way down to the Somme. It's behind the lines, behind Arras. And let's go over to that cemetery now and I'll explain why we were there. So we are behind the lines, really. We're in an area where there's lots of Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. And these are the positions of the or the locations where there was many casualty clearing stations where the wounded had been brought back from the battles of Arras in 1917. There's a lot here that have been brought here from the Somme in 1916, and it's a cemetery called Wallencourt Holt. And there are how many here? 1,500, was it? 1,300 in this again beautiful cemetery just by the main road. It's absolutely lovely. The weather's nice, and I'm here with Stephen Benson, and we're looking at a very impressive headstone, Lieutenant Colonel Percy A. Lloyd Jones, DSO. But not just DSO, he's got a number of letters after his name. He's a Royal Army Medical Corps. He was aged 40 and he's died, presumably of wounds, 22nd of December 1916. And we know a little bit about this Lieutenant Colonel, and Stephen's going to give us a bit of background.
Okay, so this is Major Lloyd Jones. He was born on the 17th of October 1876 at Brooklands in Cheshire, hence that's why he's on the Cheshire Roll of Honour. Yep. He was educated at Manchester Grammar School and became a medical professional. He volunteered for active service in the Boer War, and he took part in many engagements, including Pretoria. On his return, he went to Cambridge, and he was recognised by the Borough of Cambridge, Borough of Cambridge. On returning from South Africa, he then rejoined the Royal Army Medical Corps, and he was commissioned again in 1904. And at the time of the Messina earthquake in 1908, he was promoted to a captain.
Right.
And he was stationed in Malta.
Yeah.
He later served in the Balkans War in 1912-1913, where he had and rendered assistance in the large hospitals there, especially the cholera hospital. And the outbreak of the Great War in August 1914, he joined the BEF, going out to France in Lord Kitchener's first boat with the 4th Field Ambulance.
Right, so he was out here very early on.
He was, yeah. For his services in France and Flanders, he was brought under the notice of the General French, who had twice mentioned him in dispatches.
Dispatches, yeah.
He was promoted to a major in July 1915, had the honour of being received by the King at Windsor Castle to be invested by His Majesty with the DSO.
Right.
He then returned to France and was gazetted as Deputy Assistant Medical Director of the services to the 46th North Midland Division. On the 21st of December, along with a Captain Carl H. Barton, MC, of the 3rd North London Midland Field Ambulance, he went forward to visit a regimental aid post and was severely wounded. He died of the wounds 2 hours later on the morning of the 22nd of December.
So just before Christmas 1916, he's gone forward to have a look at something. And then whilst he's there, you know, a chance shell has hit him and he's died of wounds the following day, just before Christmas.
And
he was aged 40 years old.
The same birthday as my birthday.
Your birthday is that?
22nd of December.
22nd of December, but not 1916.
No, thanks.
And his headstone, it's got those famous words on, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends."
Exactly.
And she's certainly what he's done in this case. So a little bit more about Percy Lloyd Jones. He's remembered on the
on the Great Malvern War Memorial.
Right.
His family moved after spending time in Cheshire. They moved to Great
Moved
Malvern.
Down to Worcestershire, yeah?
Yeah.
Now, I've looked into this Lieutenant Colonel a little bit more in a bit more detail, and I've discovered that wrote a cheerful letter home to his parents on the 20th of December, which his parents received the following day. And that's another example of how good the postal system was in the Great War. And in the letter, he said that he hoped to be with them a day or two after Christmas. But then on the 21st of December, he was with a Captain H. Barton, and they went forward to visit a regimental aid post, which, as we know, is very close to the front line. And he was severely wounded, and he died of these wounds 2 hours later in the morning of the 22nd of December. In the field ambulance diary for that day, it says, "It was his last trip up the line before going on Christmas leave. It caused a mild sensation amongst us. Our captain was to have relieved him. I wonder who will get his job now. His last words were to request Captain Miller to thank the bearers who carried him down and attended to him." So this is a man, even in his last hours, no doubt in agony, is thinking of those men that are trying to help him, those men that report to him. There was a memorial service on Friday, January the 5th, back home, and Dr. Ernest Lloyd Jones received a letter from Colonel Walter Beaver, and this is what he said in that letter, and it was read out at the memorial service. "I cannot tell you how deeply grieved I am at this terrible calamity, or how I sympathise with you all and all his relations. The loss to me is irreparable. He was an officer of exceptional ability, upright and honourable to a turn, and this opinion is shared by the whole division. We will see that all is done to perpetuate the memory of one so respected.
Now standing at a very simple headstone, and it's simple because it doesn't have, I noticed the first thing, it doesn't have a family inscription on the bottom. It's got the Christian cross on there, and it's the grave of Private 22310 H. Armstrong. And his name was actually Samuel Herbert Armstrong, but he's served as just H. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong. And he was with the King's Liverpool Regiment, and he's died of wounds here during the Battle of Arras on the 12th of April 1917. The sad thing is that we don't know who his father was. We do know that he was born in January 1895 at Parker's Road in Crewe, and he was a firstborn child of Ada Armstrong. But his birth certificate, when we look at his birth certificate, it shows that his mother was a parlourmaid and that his father was unknown. And I'm sure this was a common story in those days. You know, this thing used to happen all the time. Having left school, Samuel Herbert was employed in a grocery shop in Crewe, running errands and making deliveries. But with the outbreak of war, he joined up and he enlisted on the 5th of November 1914. And he's, as I say, he's used his middle name as Herbert. He spent three Christmases out here on the Western Front until April of 1917. So between April and June 1917, the British are called upon again to launch this support of the French in this Battle of Arras. So on the 9th of April, his division was part of the 30th Division, the King's Liverpool. They're engaged in the opening assaults at the battle south of Arras, and they were to the right of the 56th Division. Now, the 20th Battalion of the King's Liverpool, they began their advance in the afternoon, but they got caught in no man's land, and of course, we know then that they were sitting ducks and casualties began to mount. The following day, more soldiers were to die whilst they were moving forward to consolidate the positions. They thought they were in British hands. And on the afternoon of the 12th of April, the battalion had lost 31 other ranks, killed or died of wounds. And one of those fatalities was our Samuel, or Herbert, as it says on his headstone, and he's buried here in Wallencourt Holt British Cemetery near Arras. He's also listed on the memorial back home in Crewe at the St Michael's Church. And we've got, as usual, there's a grainy photograph showing this young lad in the local paper. And the local paper tells us that he was killed in action, listed in November 1914. And like we said, it was out here for three Christmases. Yeah, it says that his parents lived at Bunbury, but he was brought up by his grandmother, who lived in Parker Road in Crewe, where that was the address he put on his enlistment papers, wasn't it? So there's a sad story of a man that's come out here, spent three Christmases on the Western Front. He's served using his middle name. And the sad thing is, I wonder whether his father ever knew that he'd got a son. And if he did he know that he was killed in action during the Battle of Arras in 1917. But here he lies, and we're not going to forget him because we're looking at his grave. Next to him is a second lieutenant, C.G. Gray, and he died in the Battle of Arras, April 1917, aged 22. But beneath him, there's no Christian cross, but they are remembering, or I assume is his brother, second lieutenant, G.M. Gray, Royal West Kent Regiment, and he's died in the previous year, October 1916, in the Battle of the Somme, at Goudiercourt. So we've got two soldiers there, one buried and one remembered on the same headstone, but no Christian cross. And then, as usual, when we walk along the rows and rows of graves in this cemetery, the odd German here, no doubt German prisoner of war that's been brought back to the casualty clearing station and has then died of wounds, but buried in the same respectful way as everybody else. And we remember those Germans too. Always, to me, I start at the bottom of these headstones. I read the family inscriptions, and then it tells us so much about these men. Then you look up and look at who those men were.
So we then made our way down to the Somme battlefield itself, and we headed to Guillemont to look at a private memorial that sits just in front of one of the most heavily fortified and defended villages in August, July, August and September of 1916, the village of Guillemont.
So we're in the middle of a field between Trones Wood and the village of Guillemont. And then over to my right, if I look back towards Trones Wood, we can see Delville Wood. And on the left, people that know the area, you can, what's it called? Gullimont Road Cemetery, with, 5,000, I think, in there? Something like that, and there's four trees we can see. We come to a special memorial, and on the stone here it says, in memory of George Marsden Smedley of Lee Green, Matlock, Derbyshire, 2nd Lieutenant of the 3rd Battalion of the Rifle Brigade, not aged 19 years old, who fell in action, fell in an attack on Gullimont, where we're standing, on the 18th of August 1916, during the Battle of the Somme, and lies near here in an unknown grave, lovely and pleasant in life, in death, serene and unafraid, most blessed remembrance. And there's a couple of wreaths that people have left here, and my colleague here, my mate here, Stephen Benson, has put a photograph of that young 19-year-old officer. So a little bit of background information about him. Fire away, Stephen.
So he was born in 1897, educated at Harrow, 1911 to 1915, where he was in the OTC. He was a monitor for the football and cricket 11s. After leaving school, he went straight away to be commissioned into the Royal Rifle Brigade in August 1915, and he came across here to the Somme in July of 1916, just before his 19th birthday. There are some surviving letters which he describes vividly his 25 days here on the battlefield. The last written, 17th of August, the day before the attack. And in it he said, he thanked his parents for his new identity disc. It makes such a difference having a nice chain around one's neck instead of an old dirty bit of string.
So we'll just cut in there and explain to people that the army gave soldiers two cardboard identity tags, one of which was to be left on the body in the event of death, and the other one was to be returned to the office, so they've got a record of who had died. But the problem is, of course, that these identity discs were made of crushed cardboard. They disappeared in the mud. So a lot of the officers had with them a metal disc instead, and we now know that's what George Marsden Smedley had with him. So carry on.
So it was the next afternoon that his platoon attacked here across the fields towards Gilmon Station, which is just behind us. They kept up behind a creeping barrage into no man's land with little loss. But they did meet then stiff resistance from the station. Marsden Smedley was reportedly charged the machine gun post, which was holding the area. And after shooting one of the Germans, he was shot by a German officer and fell on the parapet. Despite his identity disc, his body was never found, and he's named on Tietvaal Memorial.
So that shows that he was probably within the subsequent fighting, because that was on the 18th of August, and the fighting went on here until the 3rd of September, didn't it? It was the 3rd of September before they eventually managed to take the village of Gullimont behind us, or what was left of Gullimont. It was just dust. But why is this memorial here? Well, we know that Marsden Smedley's parents and five brothers and sisters, they all survived the war. But by 1990, with the last relative gone, the memorial that had been here for some time needed repairing. And it was repaired by members of the Western Front Association. The stone was cleaned and some of the lettering recut. White chippings were laid, which is below my feet now. And the wall that surrounds it, it almost looks like a Commonwealth War Graves Commission wall, was built effectively using bricks and stone copings reminiscent of walls to the British cemeteries, like the one that we can see just over the valley at Gullimont Road. And John Smedley and son agreed to act as guardian, and a discreet plaque on the wall confirms this. Now, it says also that his father made every possible effort to trace him, and he actually worked out, he pinpointed the spot where we're standing now, where his son was last seen, and he fenced it off whilst arrangements were made for its purchase, because, of course, he had to negotiate with a local landowner. He was upset to hear from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which at that time was still the Imperial War Graves Commission, in February 1921, that the post and wire fence had been removed. The railway and station buildings in the vicinity are in a rapid process of reconstruction, and the trenches and shell holes had all been levelled and filled in. That's what he was told. Fortunately, shortly afterwards, he completed the purchase and he put up the memorial stone, which I've just quoted at the start of this passage. And there was a small garden surrounded by a brick wall and an iron gate, which we see today. So it's really just 3 or 4, 5 years after Smedley has been killed in action on this spot. And he may well still be here. He may well still be here, somewhere here. But as we said, he's remembered along with 72,000 others on the Tietvaal Memorial. So we thought we'd come and pay our respects to that young man. And again, when you look into his eyes, when you look at that photograph, which we found on the Imperial War Museum's website, you look into his face, and he was such a young man, and he was only here for 25 days, and we think this is probably his first and only attack that he was involved in. And from that passage, we know behind us is the German front line, just a few yards away. The barbed wire would have been where we're standing, and he's got that far before he's been shot. Just one of so many sad stories, which really brings it home to you when you look into his eyes, as I'm doing now. So we've now walked up to where we were just now, looking at the private memorial of Smedley. And we've come to a memorial that to me looks new, but apparently has been here for some years, which I'd never seen before, despite coming to the Somme for 25 years. And I didn't know anything about the story, which I'm just about to tell you. And there's a very low stone here which details about the Jersey contingent that fought in and around Gouliemont during the Battle of the Somme. And the plaque tells us that they were attached to the 7th Battalion of the Royal Irish Rifles. But there was only 326 members of the Royal Militia of the island of Jersey who had volunteered in 1915 for overseas service. So the reason they had to be attached to another battalion was because they didn't have enough men at 326 to make up their own battalion, because a full battalion would have about 1,100 men and officers. The plaque goes on to tell us on the 6th of September 1916, so 3 days after Gouliemont had been taken, the Jersey men firmly held Gouliemont, the village of Gouliemont. They suffered grievous casualties under remorseless enemy fire. The survivors of this ordeal incurred further losses in the following days whilst exposed in shallow trenches beyond the village. So they've gone beyond the village. They've moved through what was left of Gouliemont, the rubble of Gouliemont. It says in the late afternoon of the 9th of September, those few that remain uninjured arose to capture nearby Ginchy, advancing bravely alongside their Irish and other Channel Island comrades. 4 days of bitter struggle reduced this proud little unit to a mere handful. The Jersey contingent rallied, going on to win further acclaim on the Messines Ridge in 1917. Also on the River Lys, the Battle of the Lys, and during the advance to victory. Yet their losses were never greater than in those awful days here at Gouliemont. And this monument stands firm in the memory of the Jersey contingent and the thousands of others in Jersey who served between 1914 and 1918. They fought in every battle on every front, on land, sea and in the air. From a community of only 50,000 inhabitants, more than 1,500 made the ultimate sacrifice. At the bottom it says, "Beautiful Jersey, gem of the sea, ever my heart turns in longing to thee." And on the broken stone, which we understand came from the beautiful Channel Island of Jersey, this memorial was unveiled, I've just been told it was in 2016, so that would have been on the centenary of the Jerseyman's ordeal here in Gouliemont. And on the stone, I say it's broken and deliberately broken, it says, "This stone commemorates the men of the Jersey contingent, the Royal Irish Rifles, who fought and died here in September 1916, and all from Jersey who served in the Great War. Their hearts, like the heart of this stone, lie in Jersey." I think for most of us, those words really do ring true. It makes you realise, again, the sacrifice that come from all corners of the British Empire between 1914 and 1918.
It's just occurred to me, listening back to those thoughts about the Jerseymen that fought at Gouliemont in 1916, that they may feel that their sacrifice ultimately was not that worthwhile. Because, of course, this is 1916, and what, 24 years later, Jersey and the rest of the Channel Islands were the only part of the United Kingdom that was occupied by the Germans, the Nazis. And they were under the Nazi control for 5 long years. I wonder how many of those men that fought at Gouliemont in 1916, who went back to their homes in Jersey, then had to see those dreadful Nazis goose-stepping through the streets of St Helier in that beautiful island of Jersey. I just wonder.
So we've made our way just a couple of miles from Gouliemont, where we were before, and we're now on a high point of ground near two woods, which the British knew as Lousy Wood and Buller Wood, and we've come to a private memorial of one of the most famous families in the history of English literature, and it's a memorial to a man called Major Cedric Charles Dickens. He was the grandson of Charles Dickens, who wrote, of course, amongst others, A Christmas Carol. And he was known to his family as Ceddy. He was the seventh and youngest child of Henry and Marie Dickens, educated at Cambridge University, and he spoke fluent French and German. Qualified as a solicitor in 1913,
But whilst he was at university, he joined the London Regiment of the Territorial Force, the Kensingtons. They arrived in France in November 1914, said he was wounded in the right shoulder by a sniper in 1915, but after 3.5 months at home, he returned to the front. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme in 1916 at Gommecourt, first day of the battle, more than half his regiment were killed. And they arrived here, the line between Guillemont and Ginchy, where after 2 months of fighting had caused such appalling destruction that a 7 mile march took a gruelling 15 hours. And on the afternoon of September the 9th, in broad daylight, in command of A Company, Ceddie Dickens was killed in an attack on the German trenches behind me in Lewes Wood. That day, the Kensingtons lost 15 officers and 282 other ranks. And at the end of the day, they retreated back to where they started from. And Ceddie was buried close to where he fell. Now, his mother was a French woman. And 2 years after the war, when she was 67, but in a photo, she looks much older, she finally got permission to visit this devastated region of France, the Red Zone, as it was called, to try and find her son's grave. She said, "I made up my mind to keep that spot, which to me was sacred, and to keep his grave there. With the help of the local people, whose village had been completely destroyed, she bought the little piece of land and planted a memorial garden around a cross of English oak. And a bench was placed next to it, and she said, where many a visitor, which I hope, will sit and say a prayer for the English officer." Every year for the rest of her life, Marie Dickens visited Ceddie's garden, which was kept in beautiful condition with its trees and flowering shrubs until the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, when it fell into neglect. Of course, she then died at some point, and in 1995, the cross was moved nearer to the road. An attempt was made to try and inter Dickens' body in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, but they couldn't find it, and he's on the Teat Vale Memorial. And the cross that we're looking at here is a replica of the original cross, which is now in Ginchy Church, and it was rededicated to Ceddie in November 2004, so nearly 20 years ago now. Just another of so many men that died on these fields on the Somme. As I look around now, it's late February. It's a beautiful afternoon, and the modern windmills are churning behind me. And as I look at these ploughed fields, I wonder whether that man with such a famous name from a famous family is still here, somewhere in these fields, along, of course, with thousands of others. When I walk to the edge of the memorial garden, there's a very small memorial made out of slate that someone has placed here close to the Dickens cross. And it says, "In memory of Alfred Walter Bower, born on the 27th of April, 1893. And he was in the London Regiment, but with the Queen Westminster Rifles. And he died on the 10th of September, 1916. So the day after Cedric, and he was aged just 23. And his family said that he's remembered with love and honour. So that's a nice addition to this beautiful little garden where we are.
And Alfred, like Ceddie Dickens, is one of those that died here and may still be here, because he's also remembered on the Teat Vale Memorial.
So we've now arrived at a cemetery called Dartmoor Cemetery, which is just behind the British lines on the 1st of July. And there are numerous interesting stories in this cemetery. We've got a VC winner. We've got a guy that was shot at dawn. We've even got a father and son that are buried together, that died together. But the one that I wanted to talk about, 39631 Private O. Whitehead from the Cheshire Regiment, who died on the 22nd of August 1916, and he was 38 years old. There's no personal inscription on his headphone, but there is on his headstone, but there is a Christian cross. And he didn't die in action. He died whilst helping construct a railway that ran all the way from behind the lines where we are up towards Delville Wood. And there was a Corporal Simpson witnessed the accident that killed him. And he said, "On the morning of the 22nd of August 1916, about 7:45, I was in command of the platoon to which the deceased belonged, and was proceeding from the camp at Milt to Freecourt, where they were employed constructing a military railway. We were marching along the new railway track when, about 200 yards after crossing the Beer Corridor to Freecourt Road, I heard a train coming and behind us on the railway, and as a precaution gave the order to my platoon to keep to the left. My platoon was marching clear of the track when, just as the train overtook us, Private Whitehead, for some unknown reason, stepped out of the ranks onto the railway and was instantly knocked down by the engine. I heard no whistle sounded. The engine driver immediately put the brakes on, but the engine and two wagons had passed over Whitehead's passed over Private Whitehead, completely severing one leg at the thigh and inflicting a severe wound at the back of his head. I assisted the stretcher bearers to carry him to the field hospital and handed him over to the medical officer in charge, who informed me that he had died before reaching there. I'd known the deceased since he joined the battalion about 3 months ago, and I am of the opinion that it was a pure accident. But the question is, why would he do that? Why, when he knew the danger, he knew the train was coming, he'd been ordered to step back, why did he suddenly come out of the ranks and stand on the railway? He must have known what was going to happen. We can make our own judgments, but of course, we'll never know. Just a few steps away from Whitehead is an officer, Lieutenant Alan Scrivener Lloyd. He was with the Royal Field Artillery and died on the 4th of August 1916, aged 27. And his headstone says he died as he lived, brave and fearless. Now, Lloyd was a Quaker, educated at Leighton Park School and Trinity College in Cambridge, but he fell out with his parents over his decision to enlist. And he explained his reason in a letter to his father, and this is what he said. "Everyone must put their personal considerations in the background now, and I don't believe you'd be so selfish as to try and stop me doing my part. Possibly you don't realise that this is a life and death struggle with Germany. Everybody could do something. I'm the last person to be a jingo and a hate flag waving and Union Jack hurrahing, but do feel that I might be useful with my motor or without it in case of attack by Germany, so I've offered my services." And we have a photo of him actually sitting in the car that he was obviously employed to drive as part of the Royal Field Artillery. But he was killed whilst acting as a forward observation post, in a forward observation post, which was broken up by a German bombardment. He was killed.
So what I've done now is walked from number 56, bed and breakfast, 10, 15 minutes up to the Lochnagar Crater, one of the most visited places on the Western Front. And Lochnagar Crater we've talked about in several previous podcasts. But today I wanted to walk up here alone and wander around the crater and just think about what it means to me and so many other people. And also look at some of the soldiers and airmen and others that I mentioned on the information boards as we walk around the crater. Now it's a late February morning, or Sunday morning, and it is absolutely freezing up here, as you'd expect on the Somme. It's Germans built their defences, as we know, on the highest points, and they certainly did here, just in front of La Boisselle. There's not a cloud in the sky, and I can see for miles around. I can see the sun glinting on the Golden Madonna on top of the Basilica at Albert, which, of course, for most of the war from 1915 until 1918, had been hit by a shell and was at a right angle. And the story goes, the British Tommies thought that if ever that Golden Madonna was knocked off of the Basilica, the war would end. And indeed, it was knocked off in 1918, and the war ended a few months later. But today, against the blue sky, I can see it shining in the sun. And I turn and look to the north, and I can just see on the horizon the Tietvale Memorial and the Tara Usna Hills, that those Northumberland Scottish and Irish men came over and were silhouetted against the horizon and were cut down by the machine guns and the Germans that were here in La Boisselle and in some of the other dugouts around me. And I can see across to Mash Valley, where the 8th Middlesex Regiment were cut down and where their commanding officer was wounded and went back to London and committed suicide just a few weeks later. And in his suicide note, he said that he hadn't had a moment's peace since seeing his men cut down in front of him, and he wished that he was dead, and indeed he was dead. And then behind me, I can see Gordon Dump Cemetery down in the dip. We've got a Victoria Cross posthumous award winner down there, the footballer. And then in the other direction, we can see towards Frickall, where we walked yesterday with my colleagues. And the sun is high in the sky, or relatively high in the sky, on the other side of the crater, where so many of those men from the 34th Division arrived on the lip of the crater, which was still steaming from the explosion from, what, about an hour earlier, if that, and where so many of them were shot down from German machine guns and rolled into the crater, which has become their grave. It's so peaceful here today. There's just two other people wandering now. No coach parties here at all. And the cross against the blue sky, the cross, the wooden cross that looks across the crater itself, looks splendid against the blue sky. But the first information panel that I come across, you come into the crater, and on the right-hand side, there's a picture of a very young man called Cecil Lewis. And he was a remarkable man.
He was the co-founder of both the BBC and the ITV. And he was a renowned broadcaster. He was also a writer, a mystic, and an Oscar winner. And he was still flying aeroplanes when he was 94 years old. And he once wrote, and he certainly lived this in his life, "You should live gloriously, generously, dangerously, and safety last." It's a wonder then he lived to be 94 years old. But on that first day of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme, he was just 18 years old. And he was with the 3rd Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps. And he was flying a Marin parasol. And he was ordered to observe the explosion of both the Lutnagar and the nearby Wysap mine crater mines. Wysap was the mine explosion from the other side of the Albert to Baffin Road, which has now been filled in, or it was filled in the 70s. Cecil went on to write a classic book called Sagittarius Rising, and this is how he described what he saw here at Lutnagar crater on the 1st of July. He said, "The whole earth heaved and flashed. A tremendous and magnificent column rose up into the sky. There was an ear-splitting roar, drowning all the guns, flinging the machine sideways in the repercussion air, like a scrap of paper in a gale. The earth column rose higher and higher to almost 4,000 feet. There it hung, or seemed to hang, for a moment in the air, like the silhouette of some great cypress tree, then fall away in a widening cone of dust and debris. A moment later came the second mine, then the dust cleared and we saw the two white eyes of the craters." Now, in the early 1990s, Cecil went on the BBC show Desert Island Discs, and he spoke very movingly of his memories of the Somme battlefield. Richard Dunning, as people will know, owns the crater. He wrote to him afterwards at his home in Corfu, and he invited Cecil to the 80th anniversary remembrance ceremony here at the crater. Now, Cecil being Cecil, of course, he wanted to come along, and it was arranged for him to come over, but unfortunately he couldn't attend. But he sent a kindly recorded message about witnessing Lutnagar explode and his perilous experiences flying over the front, and that was played. The recording of that was played during the ceremony. Unfortunately, he died the following year, but he was a truly exceptional and unforgettable character, and as I said, he lived to be 94 years old. Now, we've mentioned several times about the attack of the 34th Division here on the 1st of July 1916, and one of the information boards around the crater gives us a little bit more information. And it says that the 34th Division were all Powell's battalions who had answered Kitchener's call and as yet had been untried in battle. This was going to be their first day in battle. They were to make a flanking assault on the German front lines around Le Boisselle, and the division comprised the 15th and the 16th Royal Scots, who'd come from Edinburgh, the 10th Lincolns, who were the Grimsby chums, the 11th Suffolks, who were the Cambridge Powells, and eight battalions of the Northumberland Fusiliers, who were made up of the Tyneside Scottish and the Tyneside Irish. And 2 minutes after the mines exploded here at Lutnagar and down at Wysap, the whistles blew and the men climbed from the comparative safety of their trenches. But over 75% of those men were to become casualties, as in many places they had to cross 800 yards or 730 metres or more of open ground to reach the German wire. They were soon decimated in no man's land, survivors seeking refuge in the crater itself. The battalions of the Tyneside Scottish attacked up through Mash Valley, which is across the other side of the road, spurned on by their pipers between the Wysap crater and Le Boisselle, which was on their right. But machine guns proved the downfall of these brave men, and few made it across the 500 yards to the German lines. The Tyneside Scottish attacking the Swaben Hole strong point alongside Lutnagar crater at a shorter distance, but equally ferocious machine gun fire meant again few reached their objectives. The Tyneside Irish had the greatest distance to make their attacks, setting out from the reserve positions, which were nearly a mile behind the British front line. And men, as they came across the exposed hills, were cut down by the machine gun fire. Some did make it forward, a small group eventually reaching their objective in Contlemason, only to be lost later. Now, that 34th Division, and there's a statue, a famous statue to them in the village of Le Boisselle, suffered approximately 6,500 casualties that day, men that were killed, wounded, or simply missing in action. And no division took more casualties that day than the 34th Division. Now, on any battlefield, there are remarkable stories of bravery and self-sacrifice. And on one of the panels, I'm looking down at a photograph
of Bombing Sergeant 348 Patrick Butler from the 24th Northumberland Fusiliers, who was killed here on that day. And behind him is his original cross that covered his grave in the Overlay Cemetery just on the other side of the valley, with his particulars on there. And of course, that original cross has now been replaced by a Portland Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. Now, Butler, the reason why he's so famous for what he did here was he did his best to rescue his commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Louis Meredith Howard, in No Man's Land on that day, the 1st of July. And the memorial board tells us that, as we know, the 24th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers had to advance from the reserve trenches behind the Tara at Usna Hill and walk over 2,000 metres across totally exposed ground towards their objectives. They were led by Louis Meredith Howard, who was seriously wounded, and he was lying caught up on the German wire. Now, Butler saw this, but despite the danger, he crawled out and he managed to get his commanding officer, Howard, away from the barbed wire before carried him to the relative safety of the Lochnagar crater, which is just behind me. And shortly afterwards, whilst tending to his CO, Butler was killed by a German sniper. Equally sadly, Howard himself succumbed to his wounds the following day, and for several years now, on behalf of his relatives, a wreath has been placed in his memory during the Lochnagar Remembrance Ceremony, which is held every year here on the 1st of July 1916, and Richard Dunham himself, the owner of the crater, is here for that ceremony. And those soldiers are both buried nearby, as I said, on the other side of the valley in Overlay's Military Cemetery. It was no doubt one of the countless acts of selfless gallantry, I suppose a lot of them we don't know about, on that fateful day. But there's an interesting postscript to this. In May 2016, there was a poignant meeting where, for the first time, the grandson of the Lieutenant Colonel Howard met the grandson of the bombing sergeant, Patrick Butler, the man who tried to save him and sacrificed his own life trying to save him. And they laid wreaths side by side during the Lochnagar crater. So all those years after Patrick Butler tried to save his CO, Louis Meredith Howard, the grandsons meet, shake hands and take part in the ceremony. It's a wonderful postscript to a very, very sad story. Now, what I've done now is walk round to the British side of the crater, the west side of the crater, and I'm looking down over what was to No Man's Land, what was No Man's Land, and I can see Beecor Woods in the distance and those hills that those Northumberland Fusiliers came across. And the good news for me is that, as I said, it's a freezing cold day. There's a wicked easterly wind blowing. But because I'm on the west side of the crater, the lip of the crater, which was created by the spoil when it was blown that day, is actually protecting the worst of the wind. So I can stand here and record this next passage in relative comfort. It's still freezing, but it's a little bit better. And the weak winter sunshine is actually shining on my face, which is nice. And I've got here a German defender's experience. We get a perspective from the Germans. Now, it says that despite taking heavy casualties, most of the deep dugouts remained intact, although they endured unimaginable hardships because of the barrage, the week-long artillery barrage that had been going on. An immense good fortune befell the defenders because late in the evening of the 30th of June, they intercepted messages about the forthcoming attack. On the morning of the 1st of July came, and at 7:28, the two huge mines either side of Le Boisselle were detonated, and for several minutes a rain of stones showered down on the whole sector. And 5th Company was only able to muster 15 men. The 2nd Company was completely wiped out. Within moments, wave after wave of men in step rose out of the British trenches on either side of the Beecor Valley. Thus rolled the enemy against the confusion of trench and barbed wire entanglements. The writer says, "We emerged from the dugouts, prepared our machine guns and silently awaited the oncoming enemy. When the attackers were within a few metres of the barbed wire, there suddenly raged forth a hurricane of fire on these thick waves. Some defenders confidently stood on the parapets, hurling grenades and firing rifles while smoking pipes. In scarcely a minute, No Man's Land appeared deserted. But the British kept coming forward, and for 2 hours, the defenders' rifles rattled on. Eventually, this part of the battle in Beecor Valley slackened off, and the British, with such high hopes of success that morning, only held the mine crater." It's difficult to imagine that as I stand here today, with not a human being in sight now, what was going on that morning. I'm now looking at the photograph of a very young man in amongst a group of very young men, and these were mates from Grimsby that had joined the 10th Lincolns. And one of them in particular was Private 1216 Charles R. Frankish. And every year during the Lochnagar Remembrance Ceremony, Roger Frankish was a stalwart of the Friends of Lochnagar, and he did place a wreath to his father, who was wounded here at the crater on the 1st of July. Now, Roger has written a book on the experiences of his men in the village here, which is called The Barnaby Boys. And here is part of his father's account. This is what he wrote about what he saw that day. It seemed a long wait until 7:28 when the mine went up. I remember the ground shaking like a jelly. We'd been told that the advance would be a walkover as the trenches had been destroyed and most of the troops killed. But we knew this was not true, as several times before the attack, we'd shown our dummy troops over the parapet. Now, these were tunics which were filled with straw and wearing gas masks and tin hats. Then the reply was a terrific hail of machine gun and rifle fire. After 2 minutes, we went over the top into the churned mud of no man's land. The small arms and shell fire was very heavy. I'd not gone far when a bullet struck my equipment and spun me round like a top. But I was none the worse. It was very hard going, as I was also carrying two trench mortar bombs in a sandbag. About halfway to the German trenches, I received a terrific blow on my left forearm. I collapsed into the nearest shell hole, my arm quite useless, apparently broken. Eventually, I made it to number 2 field ambulance station to enjoy the best sleep I'd had for months. Now, in those 500 yards of the attack, the Grimsby Chums went in with 840 men. They suffered over 500 casualties, with 180 of those men killed. Now, Tom Easton was a young man that was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Tyneside Scottish. And there's a board here which tells us exactly what it was like here that day, because they come from the mouth of Tom himself. And he said, on the 1st of July, I was not yet 20. When the whistles blew for the assault, the bagpipes started and we advanced towards the crater side by side. We didn't want to look like cowards. There were enormous losses. As for 1,000 men, there remained only one officer and 200 men. Later, there was one event that remains etched in my memory. During the attack, we moved along the German front line when I saw one of my best friends sitting in a German artillery position. He called me over, and when I got to him, he asked me to sit down. I protested, telling him we'd got other things to do. He said he wouldn't take long and asked me if I could hear music. I could hear absolutely nothing. And then he described to me what he could see. He said the whole sky was opening up. Orchestras were playing, choirs were singing, and all of the ancestors were there telling him to come and join us. He held his arms out. "There's my old father," he said. "They're waiting for me." He fell forward, and then I saw he had no back. A piece of shrapnel had gone through his chest. Tom said that these things shake you, but it was a momentous experience for me, and in spite of the shock, it gave me the courage to do my duty as a soldier. And I know that in later years that Tom was to become friends with Richard Dunning, and for many years he came to the crater, came to that ceremony, and he no doubt thought of his mate that day that was having that near-death experience and going up to heaven to be with his family and his father in particular.
So by the time I'd spent walking around Lochnagar Crater, I was absolutely numb with cold. So I made my way back, the short walk back to where the number 56 bed and breakfast, where Julie and David Thompson welcomed me back with a hot cup of coffee. And it made me reflect on my feelings about the Somme in particular. And it causes me, the Somme battlefield, it causes me so many different feelings and emotions. And usually, of course, they contrast and fight with each other. It creates opposite emotions, really. I feel so happy when I go to number 56 and the Somme battlefield. I feel so happy and relaxed. How can that be the case when I'm visiting a place of much misery and slaughter, where my own great uncle was mortally wounded? But I feel a great debt of gratitude whenever I visit any of these battlefields to those men that went before me, that gave me the opportunity to live the life that I live now. The fresh air of those large fields, it clears my head from the anxieties and worries that I have at home, and I tend to sleep much better at night than I do when I'm at home. I'm always sorry to leave, and I want to return, and I'm fortunate that I'm able to return to the Somme time and time again, because it does feel like home to me. But it's not just me, is it? No doubt you listening to this podcast will have the same thoughts, the same emotions and the same desires to get back to those battlefields. Maybe you're listening to this on the battlefields at the moment. Two of the nights that we spent being looked after at number 56, we're enjoying the fine food that Julie serves up and talking to David and the others that were there about all things Somme related. And then when we looked out of the window across the Tara Usna Hills, we saw the most fantastic winter sunset you could ever imagine. It stretched right across the horizon, right across the mash and sausage valleys. And in my mind's eye, the shadows of the fallen were saying goodnight to us and hoping that one day, very soon, we will come again and bring other people with us so that they can experience what the Somme is like. So finally, as usual, I'd like to pay my respects and remember all of the soldiers that we talked about in this week's podcast with the playing of The Last Post.